Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Our guest speaker tonight is somebody I first became aware of when I started to watch Edge Media TV, which is a classic station that deals with these subjects. He approaches a difficult subject with a good deal of concise and accurate and easy to understand information, and his overviews on various subjects connected to it are extremely good. So, without further ado, please welcome former guest TV, Edge TV presenter, and noted author and historian on various subjects that relate to conspiracies, Andy Thomas.
Thank you, Tyne. I mean, Tyne gave you the really good introduction into some of the background, you know, in a very detailed way, to really, really important stuff. And hopefully, you know, for those of you that come to this group regularly, you're going to get more and more of the jigsaw pieces fitted together. So there's no point me covering the same areas tonight, but what I want to do is try to give an overview of a subject that, as you well know, is denigrated generally in the mainstream. You mention conspiracy or cover-up or anything like that, you are instantly a target for ridicule. And yet, I mean, when you actually talk to people and you know, actually get down to what people really believe, you'll find that most of us at heart are conspiracy theorists. And it's true. I mean, I have the privilege, if you want to call it that, to speak to groups not only like yourselves, but also mainstream groups. And it's amazing how quickly they will say, actually, you know, I'd always thought that, but I just didn't know anybody else thought it. And this is part of the problem, because you watch TV and you get a sliver of, you know, reality. It's a version, and that's all it is. Now, I'm aware that many of you are, you know, pretty well educated in this kind of stuff, but it's really worth pulling some of the pieces together, looking at some classic areas and seeing how a thread has gone through history of the fact that we are deceived by those that run the world or like to think they run the world, and that when we are told to ridicule people that question the status quo, well, basically, they are right to do so, because history shows us over and over again that we are not told the truth about the world we're in, and there are plans, as you've heard from Tyne, which do not include our consent, and this is the issue. So, some of this will be known to you, other bits maybe less so, but we're going to go into some areas and hopefully pull the strings together on them. So we're going to start with this. This is the classic conspiracy image that you so often see. It is the Great Seal of America. If you've got a dollar bill in your pocket, you've got this in your pocket. The occult meaning of pyramids and all of that, that is something that I do deal with in other talks. I'm not going to go into it today, but suffice to say, if you go onto the internet, you will find very long tracts basically taking this image in its finest details and tracing its roots. Now, the world of Freemasonry will tell you this is a very positive symbol. It was created in 1776. According to the Freemasons, it represents the divine being looking over the then 13 states of America. And they see it as a positive symbol. They call it the Eye of Providence. But of course, in the conspiracy mindset, this is a very negative symbol. This is the all-seeing eye, those at the top, lording it over us. And we're stuck somewhere down here in the pyramid. We're so stuck in it that many of us don't even know we're in it. And that's the problem. It's not until you stand outside of it, you see what you're in. So it's a perfect symbol, in a way, for the way things are. And I mean, what I'm not going to go into detail today is what you think the ultimate agenda is. Whether you think it's the reptilian agenda, Satanist, Zionist, EU, whatever. The frank truth of it is, maybe all of these elements are involved, but you're dealing with the same thing nonetheless, whatever you think the roots of it are, okay? We're still essentially faced with having to deal with the same levels of, shall we say, coercion, because we are being coerced to live a life that really isn't what we want. And if you look at the world today, you will find that for every mainstream story, there is a conspiracy theory. And by the way, I use that term with no irony. There is nothing wrong with conspiracy theory. There are conspiracies. We don't always know the whole truth of them, so we need to theorise about them. Anybody wants to argue with that, well, go ahead. So the fact that conspiracy theorist has become a dirty word, I think, is unfortunate, because it's a perfectly legitimate line of inquiry. So whether it be the new Cold War, what's going on in Ukraine, missing aeroplanes, the Islamic State situation, you all, I'm sure, are aware there are a thousand different versions out there that are not what you're being told on the BBC and the likes of. And absolutely, we are not told the whole truth. So this notion that we are being led by people who are following their own agendas at the expense of our freedom and at the expense of our happiness, frankly, this is not new. And I want to go right back in time here to show that this is a pattern that's been with us for an awful long time. If you go back to 64 AD, you get the story of the Great Fire of Rome. Now, it's a historical event, we know that occurred. But you'll often see the image here of Emperor Nero playing the lyre while Rome burns around him. Not fiddling, actually, that's a mistranslation. Why was he doing that? Well, even if this never happened, it was symbolic of what was widely believed at the time, which is that Nero himself had given the orders to torch the city. He wanted the Palatine Hill cleared because he wanted to build his own palaces. And rather annoyingly, other people were there in the way already. So it was very convenient when it all burned down. And what he did was, well, this is a repeating pattern to this day, he blamed the early Christians. So he found the minority at the time, and they were blamed. They became, the patsies, if you like. Sorry, come in. That we today still see the same situation going on with, as we will come to a little bit later on. So this is the thing. You scapegoat somebody else, and you blame them for all society's woes, whilst then neatly covering up what it is that you yourself are up to. And it's from these kinds of times that you get that phrase, false flag. Now, you all know what false flag means, but the fact is, it actually is very literal. Back in the days of the Greeks and the Romans, it was a well-known strategy that what you would do is either hijack the ships of the enemy or dress your own ships up in the colours of the enemy and then attack your own fleet. Make it look like the enemy had done it, and then, of course, you could sanction all kinds of revenge against them and then lead the people wherever you wanted to because they were in fear of what the enemy might do. So this phrase, false flag attack, is still alive and well today, and it means what it sounds like it means. But there's something else about these times that has a resonance. I mean, the Roman Empire was an attempt to unify the world they knew at the time, which is not so different from the whole EU project today. And this was the world that they knew. The notion of a new world order is not a conspiracy fiction, as we will demonstrate as we go through. Many cultures, sense, or civilizations, I should say, have looked back with envy at this, and the people who are trying to put the EU project today together, you know, still hold this as something to aspire to. But then on the other hand, we here in Britain, well, we didn't do too badly, did we? The British Empire was way bigger than the Roman Empire, and it was the world order, if you like, the old world order, maybe. So all the pink bits were us. And now, you know, whether you agree with the way it occurred or not, the fact is, this was, for a long time, a very powerful setup. And then when it began to crumble, there were people that thought this was a sad and a bad thing. And as we'll see, that's led, of course, to where we are at today with the current New World Order project, because that has links that go right back to the British Empire, which in itself was inspired by former empires. So, you know, there are certain patterns here that have never quite gone away. When you get to the Elizabethan times, you know, that's full of plots and conspiracies, and we haven't got the time to go into them all today. England begins to settle here. We've gone through Henry's Reformation, the dissolution of the monasteries. Catholicism had been replaced. Now the monarch was speaking for God on earth, or so at least the people were led to believe. So this is when we see the seeds of empire being born. The Armada was defeated, the Spanish didn't manage to take us over. There were various papal plots against Elizabeth, who was seen as, of course, you know, the witch queen. But in these times, you start to see resonances with things that we're still dealing with today. Right at the end of Elizabeth's reign, there was a rebellion by Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, in 1601. And it wasn't particularly idealistic. He was just trying to restore his own prestige at court, frankly. But what came out of this was something you will have heard about. So he managed to enter London. He took over the city for a day or so. It didn't work. He was arrested. He lost his head. But there were survivors of the Essex Rebellion who decided they were going to have another go. And one of the survivors was a man called Robert Catesby, and you will know him as one of the gunpowder plotters. Now, this is interesting because there's more to this story than meets the eye, and it's often not reported. So, yeah, on the surface, you've got a bunch of Catholics wanting to remove the oppression they were under. James I had come to the throne, and there was an expectation, given that his mother had been Mary, Queen of Scots, that maybe he would have been a little bit more giving towards the Catholics in the new Protestant England. But in fact, he decided not to rock the boat. He left things as they were, and that really pissed off an awful lot of Catholics, frankly. So, Catesby, having survived the Essex Rebellion, thought, I'm going to do it right this time. And the idea was to blow up the King and the Parliament on 5th of November 1605, and thus it was going to be the beginning of a mass insurrection. That was the plan. Well, you know that it didn't work. They were found out. One of them warned his second cousin, who was a baron, not to go to the state opening of Parliament that day, but it would give away. So then they found Guido Fawkes, Guy Fawkes, and you know the story. So it ends in executions and shootouts and horrible things, but what's interesting here is it was widely believed at the time that the government of the day put them up to it. Now, here we see a resonance with more modern conspiracy theory that these guys were patsies. Now, one of the people that said this very publicly was a man called John Girard. He was a Jesuit priest, and Jesuits are not generally liked by conspiracy theorists, and he was not generally liked in his time. But he was, you see him being tortured in the Tower of London. He was imprisoned. He's one of the few people that ever managed to escape from the Tower of London, even after having been hung up by his hands for 3 days. We still don't know how this happened. But anyway, he got away to France, and he wrote a history of the gunpowder plot. He hadn't been personally involved, but he had known some of the people involved. And he absolutely went for it and said what a lot of people were thinking, which is this was a false flag. This was a false flag attack. Here's a quote from his book. He wrote, "For purposes of state, the government of the day either found means to instigate the conspirators to undertake their enterprise, or at least being from an early stage of the undertaking fully aware of what was going on, sedulously nursed the insane scheme till the time came to make capital out of it." So that's very frankly saying these guys were deliberately set up to do exactly what happened, to create more oppression against Catholics. And it worked. And that's why Bonfire Night's still with us today, because it was an edict that everybody would remember what had happened to try and put off any other potential insurrectionists. Proving this is another matter, but the fact that it was widely believed tells you that, you know, the nation essentially was more than willing to believe conspiracy theory at this point. Now, something big, of course, occurs in 1666, which is the Great Fire in London. Now, we'd just come out of the English Civil War, or the War of the Three Kingdoms, as some historians prefer to call it, because Scotland and Ireland were also involved. Cutting a long story short, the English Civil War was devastating. I mean, more English people died in that war than in the two world wars of the last century put together. And people don't realise how awful it was. And it meant that at the other end of it, Cromwell had come to power, we'd had the Republic, then he'd died, then they'd restored the monarchy. But everyone was jittery. Everyone was looking for people to blame. The fear was civil war would erupt again. So when big things went wrong, like London burning down in 1666, people were looking for people to blame. And obviously, there was only one lot that it could be. The Catholics, and the Jesuits in particular. And into this morass of suspicion walks this man, a man called Titus Oates, who probably did more to denigrate the reputation of conspiracy theory than anybody else in history. Oates had himself once been a Jesuit priest and had been thrown out, and he had a big chip on his shoulder. So he basically just invented a story saying there was a big plot against the new king. They executed Charles I, and so Charles II comes to the throne when they restore the monarchy. Now, even Charles wasn't too sure about this. He could have sounded a bit concocted, but he couldn't take the chance. So Oates was given a platoon of his own, and he went round, rounding people up, basically. Anybody who he said was part of this new attempted rebellion, you know, from the Catholics. Around 30 people were executed. And yet the evidence was really flimsy. In fact, it was so flimsy in the end, it became obvious he was lying when witnesses came forward to say they'd been paid to say what they'd said. So Oates wound up himself then imprisoned in the stocks. And the thing is, you see, this had been so widely accepted as a real plot and then revealed to be fake that the government looked stupid. And this did a lot of damage to the reputation of conspiracy theorists, because ever after, they have never been taken seriously officially. That doesn't mean that conspiracy theories went away, but it does mean they were never officially sanctioned again. And that's the beginning of conspiracy theorists becoming really a dirty term. So these are events worth knowing something about, because they play a role in leading us to where we are today. So conspiracy theory went underground from this point, but it didn't go away. And of course, then when you get to 1776, you start to see the building blocks of modern conspiracy theory really falling into place. So you'll often hear about the Illuminati. Well, here are some of the founder members of the real Illuminati, which was, you know, basically a Masonic-like society in Bavaria. Many people, of course, believe that at least their philosophy still continues on to this day. Some believe that the order continues on to this day. That's impossible to prove, frankly. But certainly, they created a tier of power which ran as completely separate from the government of the day. And that's why they were persecuted, in fact, very quickly, and were disbanded in less than 10 years. But some think that it carried on as an underground movement. And certainly in 1776, that's where you see the beginning of the symbolism, the eye over the pyramid, and all of this. So when we refer to the Illuminati today, whether we really mean people with a direct link to them or not, it doesn't really matter. It is a catch-all term for the seam of power that is constantly running under everything we see officially. And this is something which, of course, is still absolutely very strong today. And when you start to get into the early 20th century, you start to see evidence that this tier of power is now pretty much in control. Arthur Balfour would eventually become one of our prime ministers, but before he did, in 1909, he wrote to the then US President Theodore Roosevelt. And Balfour realised the empire was on its way out. He had already seen that it wasn't going to last. Okay, and in a way, he was perceptive to see that. So he said to Roosevelt, look, we can all see America's up and coming. How about you and us get together? Now, Terry Boardman has written a very good book about the origins of the New World Order. I would really advise you read it. And I quote you Terry here because he says it the best. He says that what Balfour proposed was, quote, a global Anglo-Saxon confederation that would police the world with the neighbours of the two countries and through their invincible domination bring eternal peace and prosperity. So in other words, look, the rest are all foreign, we're better than them, we should rule the world. And it does look like that programme, that idea, was taken up. Because, you know, then you begin to see the beginning of the New World Order. People like H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell, famous writers, philosophers, were all for New World Order. And that phrase, the New World Order, is not an invention of conspiracy theorists. I mean, Wells even wrote a book called that. Not fiction, just a documentary account of how the world should be run. So when people ridicule those that talk about the New World Order, why? It's absolutely a real project. It is something that was believed in and held up as an ideal by many people. And of course, in more recent years, we've had people like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and Obama talk about the need to create the New World Order. But in the conspiracy philosophy, this is a very dark agenda. you know, tying in some of the things that Toyn was talking about.
Is there only one? Sorry, I'm interrupting. Is there only one, as far as you know?
The New World Order, as far as we know, and I'm going to say a little bit more about this, is essentially, these days, Europe and America. China and Russia seem to have their own plans, okay?
Yeah.
So that's the essence of it. However, the lines are blurred, and there are factions within factions, of course.
Yeah.
But it is a real project, there's no question about that. So then you start to see other clues that this seam of power really is taking hold. I mean, in 1913, Woodrow Wilson, again, shortly before he became the President of America, writes a book called The New Freedom. And in this book, he seems to be trying to warn people about what's really going on. And he's very candid in one of the quotes. He says, "Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of somebody, are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." Well, that's pretty out there, isn't it? He's telling it like it is. But then something happens, which is that Wilson becomes president. And suddenly, that's the end of any talk about that. And instead, he becomes part of the problem. Of course, Wilson was the person that kicked off the Federal Reserve, widely believed to be a completely illegal organisation which just corralled the people's money. And we've got our own version of it here with the Bank of England, of course. And, you know, the world of banking needs a whole night, and I'm sure you're going to come to that sooner or later here. There's no time. You know that essentially if you control the money, you control most things. Maybe not everything, but most things. And certainly the way the people's money was just taken from them without them realising is really worth knowing. And the fact that, you know, the city of London is a completely separate state to the rest of our country, people don't even seem to realise, tells it like it is. You know, they are a law unto themselves. But that is another time. So, the thing is, though, you can control the money, but that's not always enough. If you want to control the world, you've got to pull strings and sometimes manipulate events. Particularly during times of war, we see absolutely evidence of this occurring. Many of you will know of the sinking of the Lusitania in 1915. It was a key moment in bringing America into World War I, because they were reluctant at that point. So, the Lusitania, whenever it used to sail across the Atlantic, full of Americans, and it would reach Britain, when it got into British waters, our warships would come and escort it in, because the Atlantic was full of U-boats. But then one day, in 1915, just as it got to Irish waters, our warship escorts just sailed away and left it by itself. And funnily enough, it gets torpedoed, and as you can see, over 1,200 people died. Now, this was a massive event, and it had a profound effect. And this is the man who many people implicate with having given the orders to remove the warships. Because Winston Churchill, at this point, was the first Lord of the Admiralty. Now, to many minds, of course, he's one of the big heroes of British history. But there's a lot of people that think he was a very ruthless man and a New World Order manipulator, basically. And certainly, the clues are strong that he probably had something to do with giving the orders to make sure the Lusitania was left vulnerable. Here's a letter that he sent to an aide just a few weeks before it occurred. He said, "It is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores, in the hope especially of embroiling the United States with Germany," which of course he wanted. "For our part, we want the traffic, the more the better. And if some of it gets into trouble, better still." It's a pretty damning statement, because then a ship goes down and he gets what he wants, and of course then America joins the war, not fully as a result, but it's a big influence. These posters suddenly go around America, you know, with the mother and the baby drowning off the Lusitania with that simple word, "enlist." So, this seems to be a manipulation. And there's lots of other conspiracy theories around this, but you're getting the idea. But here's the weird thing. When it's us, right, when it's the good guys that are accused of this, everybody goes, "No, we'd never do that." When it's the bad guys, we go, "Well, of course they'd do that." The burning of the Reichstag, of course, in 1933 in Berlin is widely seen as a false flag act. where the Nazis set fire to the Reichstag parliament and blamed the communists. This really mattered to the Nazis at this point because they were not in full control of the parliament at this point. They needed something that would basically discredit the communists. So, by having blamed this on them, then the Communist Party were finished and they took over and, well, you know the rest of the story. The evidence that they torched this themselves is unclear, funnily enough. They probably did, but it's not 100% proven. But look how much we're all willing to believe it. Newspapers, historians, oh, well, of course the Nazis did it. But then, if you start talking about the Lusitania, see what they say. Oh, no, no, no! And of course, then we get Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that today. They're going to sort of reinter the bones, aren't they, with the soldiers and sailors here. Anyway, that's another story. So, Pearl Harbor is again widely seen as, if not a false flag attack, certainly an attack that was encouraged to occur and allowed to occur, which of course has resonance with 9/11, which we will come to. The thing is that America had been blockading the Japanese oil for quite some time. It was guaranteed to get a response sooner or later. It is absolutely clear there were many intelligence reports that an attack was coming. It was pretty obvious where it was going to be. There were one or two choices, but they did nothing to stop it. And so the US fleet is attacked and then America joins the war because Franklin Roosevelt was Theodore Roosevelt's cousin. He was now president. He was keen for America to join the war. But because there was a lot of business interests in Nazi Germany from America, there was an awful lot of reluctance in the nation for that to occur. But this, having been attacked by the Japanese, by a third party as it was a good way of getting them into the war. And, well, again, you know the rest of the story. You might think that it's some kind of modern conspiracy reinvention that people thought this was some kind of false flag thing. Again, not so. At the time, people thought this was a setup. Even head honchos in the US Navy. Vice Admiral Libby was one of the top men. He was convinced they'd allowed it to happen. And here's a quote from Libby. He said, "I would go to my grave convinced that FDR, Roosevelt, ordered Pearl Harbor to let happen. He must have known." And you will find many, many other quotes from similar US Navy personnel just saying, sorry, but this was a setup. But history doesn't record that. And if you start to talk about that, you're described as being unpatriotic in America. But this is the way the world is, unfortunately. But you're seeing a pattern evolve here. And then you get a very interesting scene at the end of the war. So, at Yalta and Crimea, you get this unholy trinity. Now, Crimea has often been a big flashpoint in world history, back in the Victorian days, of course, and this is an interesting moment. This is where you see the next stage of the New World Order, where the torch is essentially passed from Britain to America as the leader of the project, and where Russia is set up as the new big enemy. Now, Stalin was not a nice man, and I don't know that anybody can make any excuses for him, although people in Russia do these days, apparently. But this seems to be, I think, the time where you see the beginning of what we're in now. And Churchill is there looking a little bit sort of broken because we were broken as a nation. Financially, we were in massive debt and America basically could call all the shots. Now, that doesn't mean we fall out of the picture. It's absolutely clear that British involvement in the New World Order project is still strong and that America still needs us as part of it. But certainly they then took it forward. And as I said, countries in the East, they seem to have their own agendas. They're not part of this. Well, if you've read your George Orwell, you will know you need a big enemy. You need your Albert Goldstein or whatever he's called in the book. You need someone to kick against. And Stalin seemed to be more than happy to play that role and was foolish enough to play it. And unfortunately, we've currently got exactly the same setup now. Putin's not the best of souls, but equally, he's being set up and he's allowing himself to be set up. We are entering, or have already entered, let's be frank, a new Cold War with uncertain consequences. And we need to be very careful how we're being led down that way of now hating the Russians again. So, you know, history is repeating and Crimea once again has been a part of it. So manipulating events and wars and ends of wars, this matters. But what about creating a war based on nothing? So the Vietnam War, as you know, was a very devastating conflict that began in the 60s. And you'll often hear that it began with the Gulf of Tonkin attack. Now, what we're told is, or what we were told, I should say, is that the US Navy was attacked by a huge fleet of North Vietnamese communist forces. And because of that, the US had no choice but to retaliate, and so the Vietnam War began. Well, actually, these are the only images we've got of the alleged Gulf of Tonkin incident. Just a minor gunboat incident, which occurred every other day. I mean, this was normal. This was business as usual. The reality of the story was finally admitted about, 7 or 8 years ago, within the last decade, not that long. When the reality was that, yes, the US Navy thought a fleet was coming towards them. There was a heavy mist that night. And when you get heavy fog overseas, you can often get radar bounce back. They were seeing themselves, basically. They were seeing their own sonar echoes. And they realised this. And they did start blasting away. They decided we'd better open fire, just in case. It was quickly realised it was a mistake. They stopped. And they radioed back to the White House and said, false alarm, don't worry, everybody back to sleep. But did the White House tell anybody that? No. Instead, the next day, Robert McNamara, the Defence Secretary of the time, said, we've been attacked terribly, and we must go to war. And another interesting character in these realms, Lyndon B. Johnson, was categorically told there was no attack. And yet he goes to the journalists the next day and makes a big speech saying why we must go to war because of this big attack. And then a few years later they say, oh yeah, no, it didn't really happen, but well, you know, the fog of war. Yeah, well, for that fog of war, many people died and suffered. This is the world we live in, though, where it seems to be that you can sacrifice thousands in the name of an agenda if somebody thinks it's the right one, or we are mere pawns in this, and that's the sad truth of it. Lyndon B. Johnson, as you'll see in a minute, is implicated in many things. I'm not going to go into the sinking of the USS Liberty today. There is a longer version of this talk. If anybody wants to go onto YouTube, there's a two-hour version of this where I do talk about that, and I write about it here. But he, again, is implicated in that business. But let's just move on. So the Vietnam War occurs, okay? This has a huge effect, but it also starts to affect the way we see our leaders. And it therefore begins to eat away at our faith in those that are supposedly running the world. People like this, funnily enough. Right, Richard Nixon, Watergate. Now, here's the thing. On the surface, Watergate doesn't look like that much. Looked like a bit of a political espionage that Nixon got his fingers burned because he was shown to have covered up knowledge of a burglary. That's essentially the story, but there is more to it. So here's the story. So Nixon, of course, was a Republican. Burglars were found in this office complex, the Watergate building. Here we are, this is it, this is Watergate. Hence the appending of the word gate to any conspiracy theory in the years since, because of this building. And nobody's quite sure what they were doing in there. No one's quite sure what they were doing. But we might come to that in a moment. It's never been officially acknowledged. Nixon, of course, was accused of having set up the burglary. Now, that was never proven, but what did get proven was that he knew about it and covered it up. Okay, he had put recording equipment in the White House. And he was very paranoid about any enemies that he might have, you know, Nixon's enemies list and all this. And he secretly recorded all of the conversations, but including his own. And of course, when this became known and the Watergate scandal broke, the tapes were sequestered. And there was Nixon making it obvious that he did know this burglary had occurred and had given orders to cover it up. Now, that's what it did for him. It could have been worse, though. I mean, his secretary, Rose Mary Woods, would you believe it, just before the tapes reached the court, accidentally erased the 18 most important minutes. Oh, would you believe it? And I think we would have heard a lot more revealed on those tapes, but there you go. And then, of course, Nixon has to resign, and so, you know, that's the end of his political career. But here's the thing. Gerald Ford came in, and he pardoned him. Now, in American law, when you pardon somebody, that's it. All investigation stops. So there was an awful lot more we could have known and should have known about this, but we weren't allowed to because Nixon was pardoned. So why does this matter? Okay, here's why this matters. On the surface, it looks like just espionage, but some years later, two of the people involved in the burglary, Frank Sturgis and E. Howard Hunt, both with CIA connections, came forward and said, we'll tell you why we were in Watergate. And they said that they'd been ordered to go in to retrieve incriminating photographs that would have proved CIA involvement in the assassination of JFK. Now, that's what they said. And, of course, the American nation said, what a rubbish, right? We won't look at that. Forget them. Well, this is believed by many people to be essentially true. And, of course, Nixon would have been implicated as well in later administrations in having knowledge that this was a coup d'etat. So the JFK assassination conspiracy theories, well, you know they are rife. And we're not going to go through them all tonight. The essential problem is that it was blamed on one man by the Warren Commission, Lee Harvey Oswald. He almost certainly did fire some of the bullets. You are probably aware that the arguments are that could one man have caused so much damage to not just Nixon, not just Kennedy, but also Governor Connally in a car. Most ballistics experts agree there must have been other gunmen. Okay, there are some that disagree, but most think there was another gunman. The point here is that would implicate somebody else. That would suggest that it was a wider coup d'etat, not just one madman. Channel 5 tried to convince us last year that the other shot was an accidental shot from a security guard's pistol. And that's complete nonsense when you look at the evidence. Right, that's just yet another cover-up, it would seem. I mean, you've all heard of the grassy knoll. Kennedy was shot in Dealey Plaza. The car shouldn't even have been in Dealey Plaza. That was a last-minute diversion, which makes you think. And many people reported hearing shots coming from behind this wall. Police dicta belt recordings recorded at least six shots coming from over there. And yet we were told, no, it was all one gunman up in the Texas School Repository building. So, here's where, of course, it all starts to get complex. So, the conspiracy theories arrive. And we might have known more, except for this horrible moment here, where Jack Ruby, a local nightclub owner, walks out of the crowd and shoots Oswald dead, point blank. Now, here's the thing. He appeared at first glance to be an American striking a blow against this terrible man who killed the president. Except that Ruby himself's a fascinating character. Ruby and Oswald were friends, number one. And they were very likely gay and lovers. Number two, which is fine, but this is important because they were therefore working together. They were not just people that never knew each other. And he obviously believed that if he did this deed, that he would be let off and pardoned. But then it became clear that wasn't going to happen. And obviously, whatever deal he thought he'd signed to do away with Oswald, when he realised it wasn't going to be honoured, he started to get mouthy. And he held press conferences, believe it or not, from the police rooms. Here's a quote from Ruby. He said to journalists, everything pertaining to what's happening has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives. The people who had so much to gain and had such an ulterior motive for putting me in the position I'm in will never let the true facts come above board to the world. And a reporter says, are these people in very high positions, Jack? And he says, yes. And he was threatening to reveal more, but then, of course, he died in the police cells through some mysterious disease. Shortly before he died, he claimed he was being injected by the doctors with something that he believed was going to kill him, and he did indeed then die. So, we don't know more about that, but this lady had something interesting to say. Rose Jerami worked at Ruby's rather sleazy nightclub. She, on the eve of the shooting of JFK, had overheard Ruby and Oswald and men she said were CIA all discussing the shooting that would take place the day after. She went to the police on the eve of the shooting and told them what she'd heard, and they said, go away, stupid woman. Yeah. And then, of course, when it happened, she was in a very difficult position, which is probably why she was then found dead a few weeks later by the side of a road. So, when you look at the amount of people who were witnesses to the Kennedy shooting, by the way, a lot of them that were at the Grassy Knoll, for instance, have died or did die in mysterious circumstances. That is a repeating pattern. We see a lot of 9/11 witnesses seem to be dying pretty quickly now as well. And, you know, I think you can begin to put the pieces together yourself there. It might surprise you, though, to know that the US does not believe in the lone gunman theory officially, because after the Warren Commission was obviously shown to be not reliable, they did reinvestigate in 1979, and this report concluded there probably were other gunmen. And left it at that, and never investigated further. So they admitted, yes, it was a coup d'etat, but we're not going to say anything more about it. So who really was responsible? Well, make your own mind. Here's the usual list. Cuban exiles, Fidel Castro, the Mafia, the Soviets, bankers, the Israelis, the Freemasons, MJ-12, the UFO secret group. And I'm not doing UFOs tonight, by the way. That doesn't mean there isn't something interesting to say, but that's for another time. Black Ops military. Whoever it was, the essential view is it was a New World Order plot. I mean, Kennedy was not the greatest person on earth, but he also was not playing the New World Order game. He wasn't doing what he was being ordered to do, and it does seem pretty clear he had to go. And, of course, many people also blame this man. Lyndon B. Johnson, again, is often implicated, and certainly he had a lot to gain by the removal of Kennedy. So, this is all classic stuff, but it builds up to a place where there is a lack of faith in those that lead. Later on that decade, of course, Robert Kennedy gets gunned down in 68, JFK's brother. Luther King goes down in the same year. And it begins to look as if anybody that tries to make a difference might be just removed. And this is where you begin to see what are perceived as wilder conspiracy theories coming through. And this is where you get, for instance, the theories about that Paul McCartney was died and replaced by a lookalike and stuff like this, which I do cover in the YouTube version. I'm not going to go into that tonight. I write about that quite a lot here because that speaks volumes about the state of mind, whether you believe it's true or not. People, millions of people were willing to believe that and still are. So the faith in our leaders was falling away very rapidly, and therefore the big achievements of the time were coming under scrutiny. And people were saying, well, why should we believe anything you tell us? And thus it was, when you start to get massive achievements like this, a lot of people weren't sure anymore. So the moon landing conspiracy theories, they're always laughed at in the mainstream. It's become a big yo-ho-ho moment. And yet, boy, you want to look at the actual statistics of how many people believe we didn't go to the moon. I think at the last poll in Britain, it's about 25% of people, that's a quarter of the population here, believe it was a hoax. And that number is getting pretty big in America too. Why does this matter? It matters because if you could show that this event that was held up as one of the highest peaks of human achievement did not occur as we were told, it means that basically anything we're told is unreliable. And it really unsettles some people, and you get a lot of very emotive arguments going on the internet about this. But here's the problem. There are anomalies. You've got three bits of evidence that we went to the moon. You've got the astronaut's testimony, but they could be lying. I mean, you don't know. You weren't there. Maybe lying under oath or under threat. So you've got to put that aside. What else have we got? Moon rock. But moon rock could have been brought back by automated probes. It didn't prove someone stood there. So what we've really got are the visual images, photographs, videos. So you would expect they would stand up to some pretty good scrutiny. And yet many of them don't. And this is where it starts to become problematic. Here, for instance, is one of the most famous photographs of all time. Buzz Aldrin standing on the moon, as taken by Neil Armstrong. But the anomalies are rife, really. I mean, you can see the light coming from behind him, casting a jet black shadow, fair enough. But the body, the suit's lit up ever so well. Now, if there's that much light to show that much detail on a man who should technically be in silhouette, you would expect to see some detail here too. NASA says light's bouncing off the surface and filling in the light. Okay, fair enough. But it should then do that in the shadows too. And there's a lot of pictures, not just this one, where it looks like he's been lit up. There's another way you could do this, which is you raise the exposure of the camera. But then you've got the same problem. Yes, you'd see all this, but this would all be gleaming, you'd see detail in the shadow, and we don't. And in fact, what you see is a very subdued light. You've got a bright pool of light just behind him. And it falls off into shadow in the background, and into shadow even 3 or 4 feet in the foreground. How can that be natural sunlight? There's not even any clouds on the moon, obviously. This doesn't make sense if this is on the moon, unless artificial light has been used. Because it does look like he's standing in the spotlight. But of course NASA says they never took any artificial light into the moon. And there's lots of pictures that look like someone's in a pool of light, and it makes no sense. Another thing that makes no sense is you see the horizon line going through the middle of the helmet there. And you can just see there Neil Armstrong, who is reflected, and he's taking this photograph with a camera strapped to his chest. But the problem there is, and you can show they're on essentially flat ground, that means the horizon line should come through his middle here. The fact that you can see the top of the backpack, and you're obviously looking down from about 6 feet up, shows that was not taken by Neil Armstrong. There is something very wrong with this image. And you could go on and on with this. I mean, there is the camera, one of the cameras they took. Very basic, really. Good for the time, but no radiation protection, essentially. How did the film survive? There is one argument that they did go to the moon, but the radiation fogged the film, and they had to prove something to the Russians. Others say they never went at all, of course. The radiation would have been too much for the people. These are issues for another time. And you can see there the camera strapped to the chest. You can see another shadow anomaly there, another horizon anomaly there. Impossible for it to be at that level if that astronaut there took it. So there are issues, and you can't deny it when you start to look at them. There is apparently the sun, there is the lunar lander, jet black shadow on the ground, and yet look how well lit up that is. I mean, the astronaut's glowing. You know, it's not just a slightly subdued reflected light. I mean, and you can see from these arrows here, when you zoom in, and go and do this, by the way, you can find very high-res shots on the internet, you'll see there are bright reflective points clearly coming in from a light source right off to the side. It is not bouncing off the surface. So these are things that, of course, reveal a lot. One of the issues we got here also is you never see any craters underneath any of the six missions. You never see any soot or blackening, and NASA says, oh, well, we cut the retros just before we came down. But then look at the film, and you'll see a massive displacement of dust going up. There's no evidence of that in any of these shots. Let me take you to Mars for a moment. Comparatively, this is where the Mars Curiosity rover got lowered down 2 or 3 years ago from a platform hovering about 70 feet up, and its retro scalded the ground visibly. And yet on the moon, nothing. In fact, on the moon, there's not even any dust on the feet. It's like somebody vacuumed. It's not just one mission, it's all six missions. You get these anomalies. And given that the astronauts kept saying, well, dust went everywhere, well, there's no evidence of that anywhere at all in the visual record. Compare that to another Mars lander, the Phoenix lander a few years ago, showing what you'd expect, dirt and dust on the foot. These are issues that have not been resolved. Here's another one that's not resolved. You often see that automatic shot of the lunar lander going back up into orbit from the moon. You see the explosive bolts go off, but this is going up allegedly on several thousand pounds worth of thrust. And yet we see nothing. There's no glow, there's no jet, there's nothing. Now some would say, oh, we're in a vacuum, you wouldn't see it. Yes, you would. This used exactly the same fuel mix as the space shuttle would a few years later. And when the shuttle fired its thrusters in a vacuum, you knew about it. On the moon, nothing. It's like it's going up on a wire, frankly. Which is, of course, what many people believe. If NASA had never faked an image, there wouldn't be an issue. But they have. There's at least three images you can prove are cut-and-paste jobs. This is one of them. Michael Collins supposedly spacewalking from Gemini 10 in the mid-60s, or at least we thought that, until a few years later somebody went through the NASA image bank and found this picture of Collins in a test aeroplane, and it's absolutely the same shot, and they cut him out and stuck him on black. I mean, that's how cheap it is. And if they can do that once or twice or three times, well, how do you know they didn't do it 3,000 times? And that's the problem. Now, here's the thing. Again, some say, oh, this is modern conspiracy, retrospective, you know, changing the story. No, it isn't. People at the time believed there was something wrong, even the astronauts. The first man on the moon should have been Virgil Grissom. And here he is with the people who should have gone with him. Okay, Chaffee and White. Now, Grissom was very critical of the technology. He didn't think it was going to work. He said, I'm really not convinced we're ever going to get to the moon. He even held a press conference where he hung a lemon on the capsule to show his feelings about it. He thought it was a death trap. And he said one week to his wife, if there is ever a serious accident in the space program, it's likely to be me. And when she said, well, why do you think that? He said, because I'm getting death threats, and they're almost certainly coming from within NASA. Well, odd it was then that just a few weeks after that, he and the rest of the crew died in the Apollo 1 fire on the launch pad. Now, this was plainly suspicious from the start. They were in a very oxygen-rich atmosphere, which was guaranteed to be volatile if you got the slightest spark, and lo and behold, they all died. It wasn't even taking off, it was just a test sitting in it. Now, at the time, a lot of people said this was sabotage. Some years later, Grissom's son, Scott Grissom, had now become a qualified aerospace engineer. He demanded to see the capsule that his father died in, and he had to go through the courts for a long time to get to it, and in the end, they had to grant him permission. And he discovered a little metal plate that had been deliberately inserted into the dashboard, as it were, of the capsule, which, in his view, the only function it could serve would be to cause a fire. And he went public and said, my father was murdered. And you don't hear much about that, do you? Even though that's the opinion of the family, and it was also the opinion of the NASA safety inspector who was brought in to investigate the Apollo 1 fire at the time. Thomas Ronald Barron immediately said, this is sabotage, and he went further. He started to look at the whole technical feasibility of the Apollo program and said, in his view, this wasn't going to work. This was not going to function. And he was preparing a 500-page report. We've never seen that, but we have got the 30-page preliminary report. And it's pretty damning. But the reason we never saw the fuller report was that he then died in a mysterious car crash. So anybody else who was thinking of pointing out any of the anomalies in the Apollo program might have shut up after that, you know? But the point I'm making here, there's two points. Number one, it is not a conspiracy invention today that people doubt it. People at the time had serious issues around it and clearly were told to shut up or made to shut up. And number two, that's why this is a very emotive issue. Arguing about whether we went to the moon or not really matters, because if we didn't, or at least weren't told the whole truth about it, then everything else must be a tissue of lies. And of course, that's what many believe. And let's come a couple of decades after that, you get to the whole Princess Diana thing. This has a similar resonance, because here we see somebody that many people believe, in fact the majority of people believe, was taken out because she wasn't playing the game. Doesn't matter how many inquests you have that say it was a drunken driver that killed her, when you look at the polls, around 90% of the British population, at least, believe she was murdered, right? So we're all conspiracy theorists at heart, most of us. And the facts of the matter is, the official story does stink. Whatever really happened, the inquest did not include so much important stuff. You know the story. She broke up with Charles, it all went horribly wrong. She got very mouthy in interviews and started to make quite threatening comments. I'm going to expose the royal family. The Secret Service is running this country. There are dark forces. Saying stuff that was probably true, but probably not a good thing to say if you want to keep your life. And then, of course, in 97, the crash occurs. So, the inquests say the crash occurred because the paparazzi were chasing the car in Paris and the driver was drunk. Was he drunk? Well, probably not. Henri Paul was a professional. Why would he be drunk when he was driving? All of the CCTV on the night, and there he is, all of the people that met him said this man was not drunk. But the toxicology report that claims to be from a blood sample from him said that he was in fact so intoxicated, had he been that intoxicated, he wouldn't even have been able to have gone out of bed that day. Right? Now it's been proved the blood sample got switched. The blood sample they claim was his got switched. And they said, oh, yes, 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 but we did further tests. So well, we know it was him. On the eve of the report coming out, Henri Paul's family were called in. And they were told, don't worry, your son will be exonerated. He was not responsible. And yet, the report came out and they completely reversed that view and he was blamed, essentially, for it all. And then, of course, it gets even weirder because you've got all the claims of the white Fiat, the clipped, the car. We know this occurred. The paint from a white Fiat was on the Mercedes. People saw the white Fiat. Funnily enough, none of the CCTV in that quarter of Paris was working that night. Oh dear, so the authorities couldn't trace it. Well, Mohamed Al-Fayed, who, okay, is not seen as the most reliable of sources, but his son had just died in the crash, Dodi, said, not having that. So he called in private detectives, and within a few weeks, they traced the car, they believe, to this man, James Andanson, there he is with the white Fiat. And he denied it was him, he said he wasn't there that night. But odd it was then that a short while later, he was found dead in a different burnt-out car. There was a bullet hole in his head, but hey, guess what? His head had been decapitated as well. The inquest in France ruled this a suicide. It's that bad. I mean, this is what we're dealing with, right? We're told to believe this. So, you know, you can have your own thoughts about that, I'm sure. There are so many things that the inquest have never touched on this. They didn't talk about this. That's the clever way. If you want a certain result, what you do is just not include that evidence there or there or there. You just stick to the little bits that you want to give you the result you want. And, of course, we've also got Diana's letters to Paul Burrell, who's not the most reliable man in the world, but we know the letters are true. That's acknowledged. And she also said the same things to Lord Mishcon. And what she said was, they are trying to kill me. There is a plot to get rid of me. And we've even got the letters. It's pretty damning stuff. I mean, here she says, look, this particular phase in my life is the most dangerous. My husband, so she thought it was Charles doing this, is planning an accident in my car, brake failure, and serious head injury in order to make the path clear for him to marry who? Tiggy, wrong. Tiggy. Camilla is nothing but a decoy.
Oh.
Who's Tiggy? Well, Tiggy LeBourg was the nanny to Princess William and Harry. And it was long rumoured that Charles had had an affair with her as well as seeing Camilla Parker Bowles. So Diana's view was he wanted to marry Tiggy. There was a car crash involving Camilla shortly before Diana died, where Camilla ran from the scene, and when the police asked her why, she said they were trying to kill me. That's interesting, isn't it? It's almost as if someone thought there's a quadrangle here, we've got to remove somebody. Having failed with Camilla, they thought, oh, actually, let's get rid of the one person everybody wants to get rid of, which is Diana, because people were queuing up to get rid of her. Bear in mind, she was campaigning very successfully against landmines. Given that she was now going out with Dodi Al-Fayed, who is the son of Samira Khashoggi from the Khashoggi arms dealing family, maybe they didn't want a peacenik at the dinner table, you know? And of course, you get all the other theories. Dodi was a Muslim. Was it that they didn't want the Muslim bloodline coming into Britain? And so on. Was she pregnant? Was she not? And of course, Mohammed Al-Fayed says Prince Philip gave the orders and is laughed at for saying that. But on the other hand, Diana thought it was Charles giving the orders. So is that any wackier? There's something very dark here, and we've never got to the bottom of it. And there's an episode many people don't seem to know much about, which is worth recounting. When she was taken into hospital after the crash, she was alive. The French doctors at this hospital where she was taken expected her to live. And then the English doctors turned up. And they said, our jurisdiction, thanks very much, off you go. And they escorted them all out of the room, and they shut the door, and this is according to one of the French doctors, and then they came out 15 minutes later and said, oh, she's died. The French doctors couldn't believe it. They said, what do you mean she's dead? How can she be dead? And it was the opinion of one of these doctors that they'd basically done away with her. He was going to write a book about this. Can you imagine what happened to him?
No.
He died in a mysterious car crash.
Oh, my God.
And this is sadly true, but we will laugh, but it's obviously horrifically tragic. But yes, so, when people die in mysterious circumstances, there usually is something weird going on. And you want to name somebody else?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You know the story on this, don't you? So, Kelly, David Kelly, a top UN weapons inspector, says there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This war's a phony. He says it to the BBC. Blair and Campbell go crazy and announce his name, and they haul him up before parliamentary committees and make a fool of him. And then, of course, he's found dead in woods near his home. And it's suicide, apparently. He was full of shame for what he'd done against the nation. He committed suicide. Well, look at it this way.
when even MPs, whatever you think of him, like Norman Baker MP, start writing books saying Kelly was murdered, which he did pretty convincingly, you really have to wonder what's going on. Again, the polls are similar. 90% of British people believe Kelly was murdered. And most people said, oh, well, of course they bumped him off. It seemed obvious. And in the gut of the nation, we felt it was obvious, and it probably is. And it gets weirder, of course. So the wounds that we're told in his wrist killed him were not enough. They couldn't have killed him. There was very little blood loss. That shouldn't have killed him. His body was provably moved from where it was originally found by the search party, just slumped peacefully against a tree, to when the police photograph him and he's sprawled on the floor with a knife on his chest, like it had been redressed to make it look like a suicide. So, the whole business of the Lord Hunt inquiry was to work out the real cause of death, because there was a question mark over it, yes? That was the whole point of it. What was the cause of the death of David Kelly? And as Norman Baker got up in Parliament and shouted about this, only 3 or 4 days into the inquiry, which was going to take weeks, the coroner suddenly produces a death certificate saying suicide. And they all go, oh, right, well, that's fine. Well, we can just tidy it up now. The whole point of the inquiry was to find out the cause of death. Once they had this mysterious new coroner's certificate that seemed to know it was suicide, that was it. They pretty much ended the inquiry. And then when people complained and said this is an outrage, what did Hutton do? He put a stop on any information about the Kelly death for another 70 years. So we're not going to know now any of the details. No claim proved that it was suicide for another, whatever, 60 years now. That's the nation we're living in. And of course it stinks, and everybody knows it stinks. And all of that, of course, was a spin-off from the War on Terror. And the War on Terror, as you well know, was a spin-off in itself from 9/11. Now listen, do I need to say much about this, Fred? If you still believe the official story of 9/11, I urge you to find out more. That's all I'm going to say. I've even brought some leaflets here with a million websites on them, just so you can go and find out. You owe it to yourselves to find out why the official story of 9/11 is a lie. It is a lie. There is no question about this at all. You know the official version. You also know there are some serious anomalies. And it's worth just quoting good old David Rockefeller here, forever a target, a conspiracy theorist, and rightly so. He said once, all we need is the right major crisis and the nations will accept the new world order. And many people think, basically, from 9/11 onwards, we have, in essence, accepted the new world order. And it was called the big major crisis and all of this. It is widely believed it was a key moment in the new world order creating such a climate of fear, we gave away all of the power that we had. And absolutely it worked. And yet none of the official story made sense. You know the basics. How do you fit a 757 into a hole that's barely 20 feet across at the Pentagon? People at the Pentagon said that there was no big plane, there were no bodies, there was no luggage. It was something small, be it a small plane or a missile. Even the trajectory the plane took to enter the Pentagon makes no sense. Look up Pilots for 9/11 Truth if you want to know more. The fall of the towers, you know that many architects and engineers say it was a demolition job. The evidence visually is pretty clear. You've got molten metal rolling down the sides of the towers. Go whichever way you want. You either go with Judy Woods, energy technology, you go with nanothermite, whatever you think. This is not a natural collapse, okay? So that's good enough, and we don't need to argue. And when you look at the visual evidence of these explosions, or whatever they are, going off way below the level of the collapse, and you read the accounts of people who were in the towers who said there were explosions going off for a good hour or so, or whatever it was before they fell, this was a demolition. And if you don't believe that, well, you know the story on building number 7, which does this later on and was never hit by an aeroplane. Yes, it had a little bit of fire on it, but not very much. And if a building like this collapses due to a couple of little fires, well, look at it this way, they should have evacuated every city in the world the next day. I won't go on. You owe it to yourselves. This is running your world. The events of 9/11, right, are not just something in the distant past. There are direct consequences right here, right now, from an event that is clearly a setup. And absolutely, we've not been told the whole truth at all. and sadly the same for 7-7 over here. There are so many anomalies. They tell you they've identified all of the bombers by visual recognition. No, they haven't. There's only one that's absolutely recognised on the video. The videos they show us, by the way, are highly anomalous. The time code's wrong. The train they were supposed to catch that day never ran. And then they said, oh, sorry, we got that wrong. And then they changed the record. And there are visual anomalies too. This guy here seems to have a railing going in front of his body. It looks like a very poor photoshopping job done in a hurry. So some of the images we're told prove this are highly unreliable. People on the bus said there were very weird things going on. The bus got diverted into Tavistock Square, it would seem, by vehicles, all a bit odd. People on the train said the explosions did not come from above, they came from beneath. And there are visual photographs clearly showing a blast has come up from beneath. And therefore, what was going on with the rucksacks? Who were those people? There were exercises going on that day that visualise exactly this happening, which, funnily enough, also happened on 9/11. We could go on, but we won't. Here's the important thing. Right, both those events and other terror events around the world have been used to justify everything we've seen in the Middle East since, which is unfolding before our very eyes today. By the way, was Bin Laden involved? Well, maybe. But if so, as Patsy's, because almost certainly he couldn't have pulled this off without major help, or maybe he was nothing to do with it at all. But the worst thing that came out of 9/11 was the increase in surveillance, the increase in control. The control agenda went into overdrive, and we handed over our freedom then and there because we were afraid, and we're still handing it over now. Charlie Hebdo, name whatever you want, you know, we keep doing it. And then Charlie Hebdo, the world leaders, go into the streets to campaign for freedom of speech and then take it all away. Fantastic, isn't it? And so all of these controls we now have, and now human microchipping around the corner, you know, this is being sold to us for our protection, for our good. And it's an old trick, and I'm afraid it's very powerful. What about Bin Laden? Just a brief mention. Was the man who was shot dead in his underpants in Pakistan Bin Laden? Many people don't believe it was. They've not produced any evidence. Wouldn't you think it would have been really important to capture him alive? Yeah, well, important evidence, surely. But no, they threw his body in the sea. Out of, you know, respect or something. And there are massively conflicting reports between the SWAT team that allegedly took him out. None of these stories make sense. Some of the blokes who could have resolved the issues, 22 of them, all died in a helicopter crash a couple of years ago. That's funny, isn't it? Yeah. On the same helicopter. And now, one name that got mentioned by Toyn earlier on, by the way, is this gentleman here. Zbigniew Brzezinski, an important man in the world because he's running the show in many ways at the moment. Brzezinski is well known as an American political hawk, and he was the man that actually set up Al-Qaeda, because they went to Afghanistan when the Soviets were in occupation there in 1980, and there he is, look, giving Bin Laden a gun. And we armed the Mujahideen, and they became Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda became ISIS, who became Islamic State, or, as the BBC likes to say, the so-called Islamic State. Do these bodies exist? Yes, but I suspect, and many do, that Al-Qaeda was originally a bunch of tin pot militias with very little power. We've given them the power. After the Soviets fell, we needed a new big enemy, and this fulfilled the role for a little while, but now it's obviously run out of steam a bit, so then we get Russia back as the new big enemy. Now Islamic State, that was clearly allowed to rise. What the hell is going on? That's for another talk. It's all very complex and extremely dangerous. But why this matters is that, I mean, Zbigniew Brzezinski is one of the major sponsors of Obama. He's one of the right-hand men in the background calling the shots. And Obama, there's many issues around him, that's for another time too. But Brzezinski, you see, is very overt in what he believes. You can read his book. He wrote a book some years back called The Grand Chessboard, in which he basically outlines the New World Order plan and says, there you go, this is a good thing. America should run the world, and we should do anything we want to do, basically, because it's for the good of everyone. So is it, you can't blame him, he's out there, he's frank with what he believes, but sadly, he's got huge influence. And, you know, this is the problem. There are probably people who are running the show who think they're doing the right thing. But somewhere down the line, this New World Order project turned to a totalitarian nightmare vision that we are victims of. Maybe, and certainly H.G. Wells didn't intend this, maybe there was a good intention behind the New World Order, but it's gone horribly wrong. And it doesn't matter who you vote for next month, because these are the kinds of people who are in control. Bilderberg, the usual, Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, I mean, and so on. As we heard earlier on, power's been handed to the corporations, and bodies like this and quangos are utterly undemocratic, are calling the shots. It doesn't matter really who you vote for, you'll get a certain amount of change, but deep down, you're still dealing with the same issue, because the whole system needs upending. And whether that's going to happen anytime soon is another matter. And then, of course, you've got the accusations of the occult agenda. I mean, what about Bohemian Grove? The fact that many world leaders once a year go to woods in California, dress up in funny robes and worship a giant stone owl doesn't seem to matter to the world's press. No, this is perfectly fine. It's just a happy little pageant. But then, the fact that they sacrifice the effigy of a child to this owl, you know, is surely in poor taste at the very least. You know, they're putting Rolf Harris in prison, but hang on a minute. And the massive cover-ups that are surely going on at the moment about the Westminster paedophile ring and far beyond, come on, can they keep this under wraps forever? You can bet your life they're trying. Shredding machines must be going 10 to the dozen at the moment. And yet there's something really, really nasty beyond the paraphernalia of this kind of madness. There is a dark occult agenda, I do believe, that is going on. How much that's in control, well, that's for you to decide. But certainly, we are not being told the truth. And that's why people do now show up at the gates of Bohemian Grove. I mean, it's open, it's an open secret. It's not even denied. They just say, fuck you, we'll do what we want. We're a secret society. But people do go and they do complain. But equally, that's why many people believe there might be efforts to control us or wipe us all out. The belief in chemtrails. Whatever you think, whether you think they're real or not, the fact that so many people believe that we are being suppressed by chemicals in the air, or worse, tells you how very wrong everything's gone. That we have no faith at all in the people running the show. In fact, they're the enemy. And we're here just trying to get on with our lives and be nice to people while they're doing very dark things. You've got massive fears about stuff like the HARP project. I'm sure you're all aware of this. It's actually not currently working, they say. But it probably doesn't need to because its progeny continues on in new projects. If you don't know what the HARP project is, they basically learn to energise the ionosphere and do all kinds of weird things. But it could theoretically cause earthquakes and tsunamis. And a lot of people think maybe they're using it as a weapon. And some people think some of the patterns of big geological events around the world look a bit suspicious sometimes. Again, is this true? I don't know. But the fact that so many people believe it might be true shows you that it's gone badly wrong. And do you even need to do that? I mean, read Brzezinski's book. He actually advocates we put satellites in orbit that beam down basically suppressive electromagnetic waves that basically keep us docile. And he says this is the right thing to do. And you can read it in W.H. Smith, you go, oh, look at that. And this man's running the world. And why don't we hold these people to account? But we just go, oh, I ain't got time for this. And there are many satellites. The vast majority of satellites, did you know, are military, and we've got no idea what they're doing. No idea. So, could this be going on? Do we even need that? Are we just controlled well enough by this anyway? We just take on the messages, all right, and we've got lovely food, horrible food really, just awful stuff, but it's enough to keep us docile and sitting there and not being active. But hey, guess what? That's all right. What's not all right is to be a conspiracy theorist. No, this is what you are if you believe that there's any serious issues. You're a nutter. You wear a tinfoil hat, as we all do, I'm sure. The conditioning we are currently seeing in the mainstream media is exactly that. It is a brainwash. And it does work to a degree, sadly. People think anybody that questions the status quo must be a wicked person that's trying to sort of upset the world, and they're stupid, and they're uninformed. Actually, I find that many of the people that are investigating this, like many of you good selves, are hyper-intelligent, and this is a serious insult. to many people who've got the right to question. If we don't question, what happens next? Look at recent events just in the mainstream. Hillsborough, the fact that Murdoch was running the world, MPs' expenses, banking scandals, military scandals, Jimmy bloody Savile, who was named as a paedophile on conspiracy websites 10 years ago, and they let it go on and took no action. And now, it's not conspiracy theories, just news. That always happens, doesn't it? When it finally has to be admitted by the mainstream, it's not conspiracy. It's a scandal. Or it's corruption. And Edward Snowden. Listen, do we trust everything he says? God knows. But he's right to have exposed the fact there is a massive surveillance program, just like we all knew. But that was conspiracy theory, wasn't it? Now, sadly, the world shrugged and said, oh, well, so we just accept we're under surveillance now, which was probably the idea. We're giving in. We must not give in. We've got to fight. Here's the thing. I agree with Toyn. All is not lost, right? So I've dredged up here a lot of serious issues. You've seen them. There is a repeating pattern of control and deception and control and more control and surveillance. It's been around for a very long time. But here's the thing. A lot of people are not accepting it anymore. And the internet's been a big gift to having conversations we couldn't properly have before. That's why they're trying to control the internet and shut it down. Make no mistake, they'll do everything they can, just albeit in changing small print, to do that. The people who are trying to stand out from the crowd really want to make a difference. And instead of being treated as pariahs, it's time to treat them with respect. Because this program here is quite old now. And actually, I think a lot of people feel that there's a desperation creeping in. Maybe they know their time is going to be at an end soon. More and more people do know about this. More and more people are disenchanted with the way the world's run. Hence, all the people who just can't even be bothered to vote. Maybe they're right because the system stinks. But nonetheless, it's a sign, right? It is a sign that we need something different. And maybe there is a new dawn around the corner. We need to use this period ahead while we can. While you've got a free, more or less, internet, while you've got the freedom of speech, while we can actually have these meetings. Have you heard in France there are plans afoot to outlaw conspiracy theory? Have you read this? No, it's not a joke. Where you could actually go to prison for believing in conspiracy theories. Well, this is the way it's going. David Cameron condemned conspiracy theory recently. Clever way of shutting down conversations. We need to bloody well make sure we have those conversations. And well done, Troy, well done, Wayne, all of you for putting this stuff on. Because we have to get this word out and keep it alive. You don't have to agree, right, with what everybody believes. You're all going to have your own slightly different views on all these things we've talked about today, many other things we've not had time to talk about, but we all agree, surely, that we should be able to discuss whatever feels important and be free to do so. That's what I thought we'd fought for the last 2,000 years. And yet, they seem to want to take away that freedom. So don't let them preach freedom of speech to you while they're actually telling you, yes, but you can't say that or believe in that, because that's not freedom. But there is enough of a movement at the moment where I feel very strongly that this could change. And I think that the disenchantment that we're seeing with those in control could become something. I don't think armed revolution really is going to be the solution, but a philosophical revolution, something in the heart, something in the collective consciousness that changes everybody. Yeah, I really think there are a lot of potentials. And it means changing ourselves as well. You can't just change them out there or blame the New World Order for making everything horrible. We're all a part of it. We need to change our own lives and share this information with as many people as who will listen. Yeah, they'll make fun of you for it. We've all had that probably. But so what? You can't take a little bloody nose occasionally. We shouldn't be in the game, you know? You've got to stand up to it and say, yeah, but this is why I believe it. And when you share the reasons, it's amazing how quickly people go, oh, okay, well, I didn't know that. And that's the thing, get the information flowing, keep people out there just not putting up with the rubbish that they're told to believe and the distraction in the mainstream, which is very overwhelming. So, there is so much more we could say. I'll stop ranting now, but just do something. What I've tried to do here is just pull some threads together. We all know, the fact that you're in this room, we all know there's something not quite right out there. But you're not the only ones. A lot of people feel the same, but they don't all have a context in which to express it. And they're afraid of ridicule. They're afraid of standing out from the crowd. But we need to make it clear to them, you don't need to be afraid, because actually there's an awful lot of us. And just looking at the polls on Princess Diana and David Kelly tell you that. So, there are hopeful signs. Keep doing what you're doing. If you're not doing anything, do something. Whatever, even if it's just campaigning to save your local bus shelter, do something positive, and it will ripple out with a domino effect into the collective consciousness. So, thanks ever so much for listening. I hope that's been helpful. If you've got any questions or comments,
please do.
I'll take that as a good sign.
Yes.
I'm amazed at how overwhelming every political party is. How they're part of this conspiracy that we talked about, the New World Order. I went to a conference, or a hustings, a green hustings, and the speaker spoke at length about climate change. We were allowed to ask questions, not allowed to make a contribution, only to ask questions. So I asked the question, is it connected to, is climate change, could it be connected to facilitate harm by ionising the atmosphere with chemtrails? Mm. And he just looked at me blank, as if he didn't understand what I was talking about. Mm. And that's the response I got from 100 people, really, that were there. But there was one exception, one bloke had come over and talked to me. But in actual fact, they're completely ignorant of it. In the high ups, because this bloke was the top man, something like second or third in command of the Green Party, didn't have a clue what I was talking about. And chemtrails and geoengineering in general is never mentioned by the party that represents specialisation in the environment.
Yes.
It's crazy.
I mean, I think there's two issues there. One is, I think a lot of everyday folk probably don't know about HARP or chemtrails. They've never come across it. I suspect those at the top of the tree probably are aware of the issues, but they're not going to talk about it. There's unquestionably that there's just a blanket denial, particularly anything to do with climate change, obviously, but they simply won't go there, because to open that door, if they'd actually tried to respond to you, they would have given you a platform. They're not going to do that, and that's the thing. The clever thing is they just look at you like you're bonkers, and that's a fantastic way of marginalising any views you might have. But yes, a lot of people still don't know this stuff. And that's why we've got to make them aware. And then you might find, maybe in 10 years' time, a few hands might go up and they might know what you're talking about. But yeah, it is an issue. But more and more people are becoming aware. And I mean, I picked up a book about clouds recently, just like in a garden centre, you know, a book about clouds. And it did mention chemtrails. Many people believe chemtrails. And I thought, so it's seeping. You know, it didn't obviously believe in it, but the fact that it had to refer to it, it means this stuff seeping out. Ditto 9/11. Whenever they have to say, all these stupid people that believe 9/11 was a conspiracy, including comedians, was Jack D the other day, was making fun of them. I mean, that's sad because he's quite funny, but at the same time, the fact that he has to put them down, it seeped into the culture. Yeah, we know now. A lot of people know there is a doubt. And somebody might go, oh, I didn't know anybody even did doubt that. I'll go and look that one up. So maybe, you know, from what seems like a bad situation, something good might come. It's getting out there that you can talk about this stuff gradually now, more and more, and more people will recognise it, but still not enough, I grant you. And that's why we've got to keep talking. But, I mean, one statistic, it's very hopeful, I think, albeit in a sad way, when they had the 10th anniversary of 9/11, various polls were taken around the world, when you shove them all together in a kind of meta-analysis, it comes out that just over 50% of the world's population does not believe the official story of 9/11, which is pretty stunning. And therefore, that means that all the work that the 9/11 truthers have done is paying off. Now, you're never going to hear about that in the mainstream because they've got to blank it, but it is somewhere underneath rendering the mainstream irrelevant. And increasingly, younger people, they don't watch BBC News. They'll look at stuff that's going to tell them things they know they're not being told in the mainstream. So that's going to go somewhere in years to come, and maybe it will become part of the general conversation eventually. But, you know, the work that has been done by the truth movements has paid off, or is beginning to, though you might not think that. So all is not lost, and somewhere down the line that this will matter, I believe. Yes?
Are you familiar with Kent Hovind? Kent Hovind, an American who was quite outspoken about lots of issues. He was actually then imprisoned allegedly for tax fraud, and it stinks because I think they were trying to be silencing him because he was speaking out about the Illuminati and a number of issues.
I don't know much about that particular case. I've heard of him and that case. He's not the only one. There's been a number of American, particularly 9/11 truthers, who've been sent to prison or sectioned for mental instability for holding their beliefs, which again is quite a clever way of trying to shut them up. But the fact that they're having to do that, again, shows you there's a desperation creeping in there. It's happened over here too, isn't it? What's the name of the guy who puts out very sort of outspoken truth stuff?
Michael Moore.
No. Oh, there's some guy recently, and they basically, the police suddenly burst into his house, and some trumped up charge, and they put him over. The name will come to me. Anyway.
Fritz Springmeier.
No. Anyway, it is beginning to happen, and it's an intimidation process that we simply cannot give in to. But it's clever. And it sends out the message to those on the outside that, oh, these people are dangerous to society. We need to contain them. But I think they'll lose in the end. I just don't think that that's going to work. Because in the end, more people got outraged at the obvious abuse of powers. And I think that will show itself for what it is. But yes, it does happen, I'm afraid. Yes?
I just want to make this point again about, I think it's related to the notion of how much power we actually have. Is that, like, you present a lot of hard facts tonight, as far as I'm concerned, that mean that I think a jury of 12 people would be very impressed by. So, I mean, however we might find ourselves in court, if we can get ourselves in front of a jury, you know, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of power, surely.
Well, there's, what's the name of the chap who's taken the BBC to court at the moment, isn't he? Or he's tried to, for not reporting 9/11 accurately. His brother died in the Twin Towers, but he believes it was a setup. He believes it was an inside job. He actually has gone to court, but he's not the first person, I think, to try to do that. They just throw it out within the hour. There was no evidence. There's every piece of evidence, obviously, as you say, but that's how they deal with it, and so it gets just completely ignored. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of the Hampstead children case. This is very weird. Some of you will have seen this. So a few weeks ago, these young kids, a girl and a boy around 10, were talking about having been abused by everyone, church, doctors, you know, they were in care. And it was serious occult abuse, nasty, satanic stuff. And they came across as really convincing. Now, there's two ways of looking at it. You go, well, either that's true, and then that's really terrible, or they've been forced to say this by somebody, which is still terrible and abuse, but you expect it to be dealt with properly. That eventually came to court, and all the court did was throw it out within 45 minutes and say, oh, I think they blame the stepfather, so he's forced them to say it.
Stepmother.
End.
Yeah. Hmm? The mother.
And the mother, yeah. So that was the end of the case.
It appears a total travesty. There's no investigation.
No, there was no investigation. The kids named names. They even said that one of their teachers had a birthmark and a groin they couldn't possibly have known about. Did anyone check this? No, apparently not. So the problem is, the very people, of course, who are implicated in many of these accusations are the very people running the whole show. That's the problem. But you're quite right, there's enormous amounts of evidence out there, but they just simply declare it isn't evidence.
Well, in a common law court, a jury shooting would be the...
If they ever let it get near a jury,
you know.
Yes, sir.
I just wonder, what's your take on the another Rotherham gang that were abusing children, raping children for about 16 years? And the social services knew about it, and local politicians knew about it, but the social services knew about it all that time, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I just wonder what your take on that was.
Well, I think the first thing to say about that is it's becoming clearer that this is not just a problem in Rotherham or Hampstead. It's obviously pretty widespread. Mm-hmm. I think what's happened at the moment is that they're trying to foist all the blame onto the world of celebrity. So you're getting your Rolf Harris's and your Savills and all of that. Okay, fair enough. But the people who are in like Westminster, they are trying so hard not to let that come out. So yeah, right, Cyril Smith, he's dead, so we can blame Cyril and his mates. And yet, as you heard, there's accusations around people like Ted Heath and people from more recent times. Now, I don't know if the accusations are true, so I can't say that, but they should be investigated properly. And at the moment, you just know it's not going to get a proper investigation.
It was a Muslim gang who had raped the children.
It was in that
case.
You
can't speak against Islam in this country.
Oh, no, I mean, I think that is a problem. I mean, what they've done in Rotherham is mix that together so you can't have a clear discussion about it. Yes, that's right.
Is it worth pointing out that the 5 years ago, the only group in this country that was talking about this was the English Defence League, and they were pilloried as being racist liars. They said that in Luton they felt it was the tip of an iceberg, and this is consequently proven to be absolutely accurate. I don't think there's anybody who could actually doubt this now.
Yeah. I mean, part of the problem we've got, what we've got to be very careful of, though, is divide and rule. Yeah. Mm. Yes, there are problems, like Rotherham and Muslim, there are issues, but we are also encouraged to hate more. And that's a great way of controlling. We mustn't fall into that either. The stereotyping of Muslims or Russians, increasingly, is not helpful. So yeah, where there's blame to a portion, let's sort it out and get it investigated. But we can't be blanket about it because that is used to control us.
But it can be, but nonetheless, have we not got to acknowledge factually that there are certain crimes where certain particular groups
are far higher,
whether it's Muslim, Christian or anything. We can't deny that in the name of not only the truth, simply in the name of, we're not coming from hate, we're coming from
just
the truth and trying to change it.
But this is, I feel at the moment we're at a really interesting time. How long can you keep all this stuff under the carpet? They're trying, but how long? It needs one whistleblower or something to burst, and I think we're going to get a very different view of society. And it will be quite nasty for a while, and I think it will be upsetting, but we need to go through that. We need to kind of get over that and see the reality and really deal with it. And I think, we are certainly, at the moment, still, you can feel it's holding back a dam. It's like a wall of stuff, and they're just about pushing it out of our consciousness, but I don't know. I don't know how long you can do that for.
Andy, our speaker last week, Ray Sheath, spoke of a period of uncertainty that could happen after the general election. If it's a very, very split coalition or a non-coalition, and that could be a period of chaos, maybe also opportunity to push forward. There may be a lot of MPs have been voted out, or parties that have become more powerful that were smaller parties before, and it could be an opportunity to push these ideas forward when things are in turmoil before a possible second election.
So.
Yeah.
yes, I mean, if we get a massive period of uncertainty, I agree, it's going to offer an opportunity. A lot of stuff to be discussed that wouldn't normally get a hearing, but I expect they'll try and move on from that quite quickly. But yeah, I mean, the election is interesting because although I'm saying it doesn't make that much difference, I will personally vote. I don't personally go down the Russell Brand view because although I know the system is set up completely against us, I don't want to give them the impression that I don't care. Right, I do care. I know that my vote, where we live, is not going to make any difference, right? Because the Tories are going to win regardless, okay? But I'm still going to vote because I like to believe one day the system could be changed in enough of a way to make it workable. It isn't today. It just doesn't function properly. But it could change. And I think the only problem is if everybody says we're not participating, the hope is they think, oh, we'll change it. But I think more likely they think, great, they don't care, we just do what we want.
Yeah.
And that's a real danger. So I will be voting even though I think there's serious issues around it. But that's a personal view. Or Don't just not vote, go and spoil your vote. You know, make your voice heard, write something on it, because it has to be counted. You know, but just do something, and then the more they realise this isn't working, sooner or later something's going to start falling in on itself. You know.
Do you think that if there, you know, if there was a crisis, that crisis they could lose control, and that would be an opportunity for us, or would, you know, the crisis be managed in such a way that it's been engineered? I mean, in Australia, they've been talking about people on benefits, if they don't have immunisations, their benefits would be taken away.
I know.
You know, and there's been conspiracy theories about, you know, the Georgia Stones, about depopulation, you know, if there was, you know, Ebola, and how these things can be manipulated to form a crisis, and then they can consolidate more centralised power, or could it be a situation where they just, something gets out of control and they lose control as well?
Well, look at it this way. I don't think, for all we're talking about, like, new world orders and ruling elites, and that, I don't think they're all powerful. They might like to think they are. Yeah. They make mistakes. And there are also factions within factions. And that offers hope. Because I don't think the new world order project is 100% united. Mm. And I think they could slip up, yes. And I think they could suddenly find things they think are so sewn up might not be. Yeah. Because so many people are now waking up.
Yeah.
I think they don't quite know how to cope with it. And only one thing needs to go wrong that they haven't planned for. And yeah, we could be really uncharted waters.
And what you might just say might just be actually something of an understatement. I know we can't prove anything in here. But the idea that it seems to be a lot of people who have bought into varying degrees of awareness of conspiracy potentially fall into a sense of powerlessness at the idea of some kind of homogenous them, which is, you know...
Yeah, but
there are many very, you know, fucked up individuals, as we know, who are vulnerable and arguably need healing.
Just to say that some of our books and literature here about the subjects that we've covered tonight and other subjects as well, so anybody who's interested, please...
And can I just do an advert for an event this coming Friday? Some of you know, we have the Changing Times group up in Burgess Hill. If you're interested in lunar conspiracy, we've got Marcus Allen, it's one of the most famous lunar conspiracies talking. Go on to the website changingtimes.org.uk and you'll see the details. Burgess Hill, 8 o'clock this coming Friday. So if you're interested, have a look at changingtimes.org.uk. And he awaits the UK publisher of Nexus magazine.
Yeah.
Which is, again, is worth something you should be reading. But listen, I mean, I'd just like to say thank you to Toyn for putting this on and inviting me, and thanks for all coming out. I mean, fantastic stuff. Keep going.
Thank you very much.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.